Hello, my name is Zachary Corser. I'm a fellow here at the Legatum Institute, and I'm very pleased to be with Angus Deaton, professor at Princeton University. He's just published a new book called The Great Escape, Health, Wealth, and the Origins of Inequality. And thank you very much for joining us here in London today, Angus.
It's a real pleasure to be here.
I have a few questions related to your book about inequality. Two questions, one that relates to the way in which political leaders conceive of inequality, and particularly global actors. And the second, a question relating to foreign aid, because you raised some really interesting questions about the effectiveness of aid, mm-hmm. and maybe in trying to do good, we have some counterintuitive or maybe opposite effects. So first question I would have, you just gave us a really interesting talk about your book, and you raised Robert McNamara, former Secretary of Defense of the United States, later a head of the World Bank, but also an executive for the Ford Motor Company once upon a time, right. and also had a lot of involvement in World War II in terms of thinking about the bombing campaigns on Japan. He was very much a linear thinker. Linear programming sort of guided his notion. And obviously, he had some tremendous failures politically because of this. Mm-hmm. I'm curious, thinking about a point that you draw in your book, which I think is a very good one that fits very much within how Legatum thinks about prosperity. You state that in talking about what political leaders and others should think about in terms of what's most important, the story of human well-being, of what makes life worth living, is not well served by only looking at a part of what's important. I'm curious, how can we push global actors to take a more holistic view of prosperity? And how and why a country prospers?
I'm not entirely sure, but I think it's a very important enterprise. I think in some ways, part of writing this book is to do that, is to have people think about global prosperity in this very broad way. Mm-hmm. And I think that unites a lot of people across the political spectrum, from mm-hmm. the left to the right, and sort of thinking about human well-being in a sort of general way. I think part of what people are realizing, and it's a realization that began to come to me before I wrote this book, but as I wrote this book, is just the extraordinary importance of politics. Mm-hmm. And that politics is a very important component of human freedom too, because a huge amount of the stuff that we need to do to make our lives worth living has to be collectively organized. Mm-hmm. You can't do it by yourself. Mm-hmm. We can't do clean water by ourselves. I mean, we can't do vector control, meaning, you know, the control of pests that cause disease and so on. And, you know, the provision of roads and all the things that governments do is very hard to do for ourselves. Mm-hmm. So we've got to do it with other people. And if you're going to do it with other people, you've got to persuade other people and talk to other people and somehow... Mm-hmm. Do that. And that's a very, very hard thing to do because there's lots of bad politics around the world. And so part of my purpose in writing the book is to try and have people come along that. The McNamara example, I think, is a good one because people look back on the Vietnam War as a great failure. Mm-hmm. And I think one of the great failures of the Vietnam War was to view something that was really a political problem as if it were an engineering problem, mm-hmm. bring the Ford Motor Company to help solve the Vietnam War. And the truth is, you can't do it. It was a disaster. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't just a disaster because, you know, the troops weren't good enough or mm-hmm. they were better than we were or whatever. It was a disaster because it was seriously misconceived and you mm-hmm. can't do those sort of things. And, you know, I think that's still a problem with a lot of the way we see economic development today. We're seeing it as an engineering problem, mm-hmm. what I call in the book the hydraulic illusion. Mm-hmm. And you've got to think about politics.
You, as I get to know you and your work, I'm impressed by how much you talk with philosophers, people who think about ethics, that you're willing to work outside of your discipline and engage people outside of economics. I'm curious how much a sort of interdisciplinary approach has instructed your work or given you a guidance.
I think it's been very, very important for me. I'm not entirely sure why. I think after a while you sort of get bored in your own discipline.
True.
It's good looking out there. I was fortunate enough to be educated here, mm-hmm. which I think at its best, at least in Britain, and I hope it's still true, there was a system in which you did a tremendous amount of specialization very early on, mm-hmm. but that gave you a lot of freedom to develop interests mm-hmm. in other things. When I was sort of very young as a research officer in Cambridge, there was a lot of interaction between economics and philosophy at that time, mm-hmm. which has since, to some extent, been lost. Mm-hmm. Amartya Sen has always been a very important force in reading his work. Not always that I agree with it, but often, you know, responding to it. Mm-hmm. And so he's always had this very strong interest in philosophy and economics. Mm-hmm. You know, welfare economics used to be very important. It's vanished out of economics. Mm. But the philosophical questions have not gone away. Mm-hmm. So talking to philosophers, I try to understand how philosophers think about these things nowadays. It's also true that I'm fortunate enough to teach in a public policy school, where I have colleagues who are mm-hmm. political scientists, as well as colleagues who are psychologists and demographers, mm-hmm. and so on. And that's been very important for me, too. And I guess the other thing is I was fortunate enough, by accident, it's sort of like this old maxim that what you think depends on where you sit. Mm-hmm. My office was next door to Danny Kahneman's for a while, and that was, you know, very influential mm-hmm. Circumstance, mm-hmm. Too, which has helped change my thinking a lot. So try to keep yourself young by doing it doesn't work, but you can try.
Oh, I definitely see some youth in your thought, no doubt. One last question in talking about inequality. You know, part of your book is devoted, I think, of course, to the idea of how can we alleviate inequality amongst countries that continue to suffer from poor health, low incomes, other problems that we could call a problem of inequality. And you highlight the notion of foreign aid as being perhaps counterproductive. I'm curious that it seems counterintuitive to say right. that you know this raft of NGOs and other types of organized governmental aid is actually causing more harm than good. Why is that?
Well, it comes back to what we were talking about before, which is you know politics mm-hmm. once again, and that I think you know prosperity depends, among many other things, on there being some sort of deal between the governed and the governed, the governors and the governed, mm-hmm. In terms of, you know, we pay taxes and we get stuff back from them and we can't get that stuff any other way. And, you know, if a lot of that stuff is provided from the outside, that breaks the links of accountability in a way that can be very deleterious. Mm-hmm. And that's what I really worry about. I think, though, when you think about aid, I think about aid in the sense that you said it does more harm than good. I think of that as aid in the countries, where you take money, you go do things in the countries. Aid from outside that helps the countries is a different thing. Mm-hmm. And I mean, I think the greatest gift, if you like, that the West has given the poor countries, you know, the germ theory of disease would be way up there mm-hmm. somewhere. I mean, sort of understanding how all this bad stuff happens mm-hmm. is something that developed in Northwestern Europe, you know, in the 19th century. And understanding that has saved countless lives, and exporting that has been, if you like, a form of aid. But it's not like you do a project or you build a dam or you build a road in mm-hmm. the country and pay for it. You expand basic knowledge. And that basic knowledge is, you know, the foundations of prosperity around the world. Mm-hmm. So I think we can do a lot that way. We could probably do a lot less of selling arms to countries around the world. You know, mm-hmm. there are bad things that we do, too. And also, you know, we have domestic policies like cotton subsidies or something, which are to protect American cotton growers.
Sugar subsidies
and so on, which are doing a lot of harm to mm-hmm. people in Africa. Subsidizing food is a little more complicated because, you know, it lowers the world price of food, which helps mm. some people, mm-hmm. Even though it hurts growers. But things like cotton, people don't eat cotton. People don't eat sugar in large quantities either. So, you know, those things seem just extremely harmful.
Okay. Yeah. Well, Angus, thanks so much for joining us here today.
Thank you.
Thanks very much for speaking with us. And I have to say, I really enjoyed your book.
Thanks very much. It's been a great pleasure to be here.
Thanks.